Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest police shootings of African-American men caught on video, first in Louisiana and the next day in Minnesota. Vernalia Randall, Emerita Professor of Law at the University of Dayton and author of Dying While Black, joins us to discuss the growing outrage at yet more graphic evidence of police shooting African-American men who were killed for selling CDs in front of a convenience store in Baton Rouge in the first instance, then in the second instance killed after being pulled over in a St. Paul suburb for a broken taillight. We'll look into this persistent problem with police culture, where police officers often see the neighborhoods they patrol as enemy territory, with many having been recruited from the military after service in war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then a speculation grows that Donald Trump appears more interested in winning the presidency than serving as president, together with the scenario that Trump will seek an exit strategy before the election to avoid a humiliating loss. We will speak with Alexander Kesar, a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He joins us to discuss the possible scenarios involving the Electoral College that would come into play if the unconventional candidate decided the fun was over and he did not want the grueling job of governing and would rather return to his business as an even bigger media celebrity. Then finally, we'll examine how abortion politics are preventing the urgent action needed to stop the Zika virus from spreading in the United States as House Republicans try for the fifth time in 7 years to eliminate the Title X family planning program, which provides contraception and family planning services to low-income American women. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health, joins us to discuss his article at the Chicago Tribune, Congress Lets Abortion Politics Derail Zika Fight, and the irony that many of the 24 states trying to defund Planned Parenthood who have declined Medicaid expansion are in the South, where the Zika virus will spread unabated. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UC Hammer Forum this coming Tuesday, July the 12th at 7:30 p.m., that I'm moderating Justice in the Balance. Amid gridlock over the replacement of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, we'll examine recent decisions from an evenly divided court with Linda Greenhouse, a lecturer at Yale Law School and a contributing columnist to the New York Times. Again, this coming Tuesday, July the 12th at 7:30 p.m., Justice in the Balance at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westford, free and open to the public. Join me. And joining us now is Vernalia Randall, who's an Emerita Professor of Law at the University of Dayton. Her writings are at her website, racism.org, and she is the author of Dying While Black. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Welcome to Background Briefing.
Vernalia Randall.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And there's an echo here for some reason or other. And Vernalia, we've spoken in the past, of course, at the time of the Michael Brown shooting in Missouri. It's kind of tragic, isn't it, that we have to return to this same conversation? You know, as an African American mother, do you worry about your children and your grandchildren?
All the time. I mean, it's a constant fear. It's a constant stress. And I'm 73 years old, and I just think things are as bad now as there were for my father and grandfathers in the 20s and 30s. And I worry about my children, my grandkids. Not only the fear is the problem is not only the danger that comes from uncontrolled extrajudicial lynching that is occurring by the police, but also the stress that it causes on people that makes black people more unhealthy than whites at the same income. I spent a good hour with both of my sons this today, you know, helping them process what it means to be a black man in this society.
And what happened to all of the outrage after Ferguson, Missouri, the so-called reforms with body cameras, etc.? Again, these videos that recorded these latest shootings were not done by the police. One was done by, I think, the owner of the convenience store, and the other by the girlfriend of the young man who was shot in Minnesota.
Well, first of all, I never was a supporter of body cams as a way of getting rid of the problem. For one thing, unless you have body cams that can't be cut off, you have the exact problem that we have. People have body cams and they don't cut them on, and they cut them off. The other problem that has, they're now starting to try to use the body cams in a way to nullify it. So you will see that in many of these videos, the police are shouting, stay still, don't move, I'm afraid. So they're using the video to try to set up a defense for their behavior. The reason we have this is because we have created a police force and we don't want to do anything to stop it, the universal we. We want a police force that is aggressive. We are hiring people out of the military who have been in war zones. We're hiring them to be police because we see them for a lot of reasons as the first line of defense. But what happens then is if you train people to be more aggressive, if you hire people who come out of a war zone, then they are going to be more aggressive and act like they're in a war zone, and they're going to do that disproportionately on blacks and Hispanics and Native Americans because of their racial biases.
Well, the UK Guardian newspaper has been keeping counts, and so far this year, 2016, 136 African Americans have been killed by police. So it's clearly not going away. And in these last 2 days, one after the other, first in Louisiana and then second in Minnesota, in particularly graphic, horrible incidences, and the idea that people die because they're selling CDs in front of a convenience store or they have a broken taillight, at the end of the day, that's what it sort of comes down to. So I can understand that African Americans in this country must feel that, you know, at all times they're in a war zone for the want of a better description.
They're what? I didn't understand.
I said, do you think African Americans feel, you mentioned the police are recruited having come from war zones. Do you think because people are killed for the most minor reasons, in the Louisiana case for selling CDs in front of a convenience store, and in the case in Minnesota for having a broken taillight, that must, as an African American, you must be always afraid that at any moment you're in effect living in a war zone.
In fact, to a large extent, I wish we were living in a war zone because maybe we would fight back like we were in a war zone. In fact, what I feel like we live in is in a occupied territory. In which, like South Africa, or like Palestine, where we can be killed and abused without retribution, and there are things that people could do. There are things that the government could do to affect a change, but they don't. And they always, when they go to do something, they always fix they go to something that doesn't require them to make the police accountable. At the end of the day, the law has to be changed where police will be held accountable, and the money has to be restricted where cities have an incentive to make police accountable. As long as the federal government is giving money without making police cities accountable for what their police do, the racial disparities will continue.
Well, of course, the government is headed up by an African-American, President Barack Obama. And today he said, rather than fall into a predictable pattern of division and political posturing, let's reflect on what we can do better. So is there, I know that we had similar remarks.
Well, President,
go ahead.
President Obama, I'm here to tell you what you can do better. You can issue an executive order that restricts funding based on racial disparities. You can say that if there is a police shooting in a city, that the fundings will be immediately stopped until the investigation is done, and that there will that you can't stop give selling actually and providing. I'm so mad at him. I mean, you know, the thing is President Obama comes out and says something that is sort of like, oh, we all should look at what we all can do. Why didn't he come out and say, I'm sick and tired of this. This is what I'm going to do. Whether or not you do anything, this is what I'm going to do.
Well, specifically, just quoting him, to admit we've got a serious problem is in no way contradicts our respect and appreciation for the vast majority of police officers who put their lives on the line to protect us every day. It is to say that as a nation, we can and must do better to institute the best practices that reduce the appearance or reality of racial bias in law enforcement. So
why didn't he come out with an executive order that would have pushed people to have to admit it and deal with it?
Well, it does. Go ahead.
I guess I just feel like that's more of the same from him. A little bit more down the road, because he is at least speaking about the racial disparities and that it happens to black people. But he still hasn't moved to doing what he can do. I mean, not just recognizing it, implementing executive orders, agencies, Department of Justice, setting up a law, I know he doesn't have a control over Congress, so a lot of what he has to do has to come through administrative orders, regulations, and agency enforcement. And he didn't talk about any of that. Maybe he plans to come out with it sometime soon, but as long as this has been going on, there shouldn't be a need to study what needs to be done. He should be able to come out and say, this is what I'm going to do. Governors, this is what I'm going to do. Mayors, this is what I'm going to do. Everybody wants to talk about it. That's what admitting. I'm just so frustrated.
Sure. Well,
and so scared.
Well, just in closing, Vanilla Randall, when we talk about the police culture and the recruiting from people who've fought in war zones and the attitude continuing that you're patrolling the streets of a neighborhood as if you're patrolling hostile territory, what can be done to undo that culture if that's indeed a part of the problem?
Well, we created the culture in the last 20 or 30 years, so it's going to take a while to undo it. But what can be done is to make people visibly responsible. Right now, what's the problem we have now is every single time a death occurs and a police get off, there is no incentive for the police to change their behavior. There is no incentive for the culture to change. So what has to happen? Two things. One, I think we need a change in law that makes the killing of unarmed people by police unreasonable behavior. I think, secondly, we need to make police become true professionals, and at a minimum, that means make them have to have liability insurance. Cities need to stop paying for police misconduct. Police need to be paying for that. And just like I, as a lawyer and as a nurse, have to have had malpractice insurance that cover my misbehavior, police need malpractice. If police begin to have to pay out of their pockets for their misconduct, they will think twice about engaging in it.
Well, I think you've put forth some very, very reasonable and very practical solutions. Just in closing, you started out by saying you don't think things have improved at all, even back in the days of your grandfather.
I think we've created a new system, and we made it colorblind, so we don't think it's a new system. And I think we look at police, but if you look at the disparities in employment and in wages and in the discrimination that happens in every area of black people's life, my own, as a law professor, I got paid less than the white male law professors. In every area of our life, we are discriminated against. If you couple that with the imprisonment of black people and felony disenfranchisement of huge numbers of black people, disproportionately black, and then you couple that with the lynching, the extrajudicial lynching that occurs by police, you have the exact same system of Jim Crow. Exact.
Well, Vidalia Randall, I thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry that we have to speak under these conditions, but I'm grateful for your time and your wisdom. I thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Vidalia Randall, who is Emerita Professor of Law at the University of Dayton. Her writings can be found at her website, racism.org, and she's the author of Dying While Black. We'll take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether Donald Trump wants to win the presidency but not be president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexander Kesar, who is a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Kesar.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And you mentioned extensively in an article in Thursday's New York Times by Jason Horowitz titled, Would Donald Trump Quit If He Wins the Election? He Doesn't Rule It Out. And apparently in an interview that Donald Trump did with Jason Horowitz of the New York Times, Horowitz asked him that if he beats Hillary Clinton and wins the presidency, would he forego the office as an ultimate walk-off winner? To which Donald Trump flashed a mischievous smile and said, I'll let you know how I feel about it after it happens. So that's the context for our conversation here. So just to start with that, how does that strike you? It's an odd thing for a presidential candidate, even if he was being coy, to say.
Yes, I was surprised when Jason Horowitz told me that story. I would have expected that a presidential candidate would have uttered an instant and strong denial, saying, of course not, that's ridiculous. I want to be president and I want to serve. On the other hand, Trump may have been gauging in some intuitive and impromptu way that he would get more attention and become more the focus of attention and intrigue if he played it coy.
Well, I've been speculating on this radio program for several months now that Donald Trump is more interested in winning the presidency than serving as president. And President Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner said that Trump basically entered the race to improve his brand and to sort of give it more marketing visibility. And it seems if that's the case, it sort of caught him by surprise. So there's an awful lot of speculation that makes this current comment by him, makes one want to look at it. But the kind of work that you do in looking at elections and particularly Electoral College, and I believe you're writing a book about the Electoral College, are you not?
I am indeed. I'll put in a little plug. It's called Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? And it should be out in a few months.
And that's a good question. And there have been efforts to bypass the Electoral College, has there not? There have been some initiatives at the various state levels?
Well, there's a recent movement called the National Popular Vote Initiative, which has won support in about 8 or 9 states to create a mechanism that would bypass the Electoral College. There's also a long history, which is largely forgotten, of very serious attempts to get rid of the Electoral College by Congress. As recently as the late 1960s, the House of Representatives approved by well more than a two-thirds vote a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College, and it was defeated by a filibuster in the Senate. So there was an immense amount of support at that point for abolishing the very archaic institution, but it did not quite happen.
But the initiative that you just mentioned would be a simple way to get rid of it, wouldn't it? The National Popular Vote.
The National Popular Vote Initiative, and it's an elaborate mechanism which would come into force only if enough states signed onto the initiative to cast a majority of the electoral votes in the country. But it would be in its pure form, in its existing form, it would be a way to actually to utilize the Electoral College, but to make the electoral votes cast by each state conform to the outcome of a national popular election. So in a certain way, it would be circumventing the Electoral College. My strong guess has always been that if we got to that point, then Congress might finally act to simply get rid of the Electoral College and have a national popular vote.
Well, what you're describing, of course, is purely democratic in the small d, right? I mean, if the people vote a certain way, then the Electoral College should reflect those votes. The reason we're talking about the Electoral College is in the scenario if Trump were to quit after he wins, and so there's speculation he may quit before that if he's facing humiliation and public ridicule and is likely to wipe out the Republican Party. And of course, as we know, there are a number of delegates already organizing before the Republican convention, which is only 2 weeks away, to dump Trump at the convention. So there's all kinds of, efforts going on here. But let's focus on what you specialize in, Alexander Kasar, and that is the Electoral College. Assuming that he proves his point, that Trump, he wins, but then he doesn't really want the job, and he goes back to building hotels. What would the role of the Electoral College be then in terms of honoring the votes? Because there have been instances, I understand, where the, 586 electors, whatever the number is, some of them don't necessarily vote the way they should.
Right. I mean, the question would be, now, I mean, I should say that I, like everybody else, would be speculating, since we don't have any precedents of people winning presidential elections and then saying, never mind. But if he were to win the election in early November and then withdraw, it would depend on when he withdrew. If he withdrew before the electors meet in the states, which happens in early December, I'm not sure the exact date, but it's sometime in early December, when the electors meet each in their own state and actually cast their electoral votes. If he withdrew before then presumably the electors would be able to vote for another candidate, or the electors who were pledged to Trump would vote for another candidate. Presumably the electors who were pledged to Hillary Clinton would continue to vote for Hillary Clinton. But so they might rally around another, you know, one particular candidate, or I think what might be more likely to happen in that scenario is that they might spread their votes over several different Republican candidates. And the upshot of that would be that nobody would have a majority of all of the electoral votes. And our Constitution requires that you have a majority of electoral votes. And if you don't, and if that were the scenario, then we would be in this situation where the election reverted to the House of Representatives, but not with the House of Representatives voting, with each representative having one vote, but with each state having one vote. And that's how the presidency would be decided. It would almost surely guarantee the election of a Republican, since a significant majority of the state delegations have Republican majorities.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Kesar, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. So actually there are 538 electors. Right. So if you cut that in half, what's that? 269, right?
So 270. 270 is what you need to win.
270, right. So you'd have to have the one over the top, right? So you'd need 270 to win. And of course, if Hillary came in second, the fact that she came in second and the number one guy quit, the logic would say, well, then she should be president. But it doesn't work that way, right?
Right. The logic is not, you know, what obtains here. Now, you know, that said, again, we're talking about very unusual scenarios. You know, if it were, for example, a very close election, and I guess it would not be inconceivable that some of the Republican electors might embrace the logic that you articulated, saying, well, Hillary came in second, so I'm going to cast my electoral votes for her. There would be nothing to prevent that from happening except party loyalty, but I suspect that party loyalty would play a role there.
But I'm curious to know who these electors are and how comes so much power is vested in them.
Well, I mean, these electors now are, I mean, it varies in different states. I mean, the only thing that the Constitution specifies is that they cannot be people who hold high political office. So they tend to be people who are active in party or partisan circles, but at more or less a local level, and are not certainly are not high office holders. But they have demonstrated some loyalty to the party.
But that there's no binding loyalty, is there? I mean, it doesn't sound like
that's right. I mean, it's a question which is, there have been periodic legal debates and disputes about whether whether you can legally bind an elector to vote for the person that they were pledged to, or even the party. In general, the conclusion to that is no, you can't bind them. And the reason for that, in part, of course, is that the original design of the Electoral College, part of the rationale for its being created was to say that those electors should be free to use their own judgment. And that's why we had this Electoral College system, where you would choose people who would be knowledgeable and might know more about the candidates, and they would exercise their own judgment. Now, that has very rarely happened. There have been faithless electors in the past. The most numerous case in recent history, I think, was in 1960, when there were 15 or 16 Democratic electors who refused to vote for John Kennedy. I think the basic legal situation is that they would be free to do whatever they wanted.
And in the case of those that didn't vote for Kennedy, it didn't swing the election, even though it was a close election.
That's right.
But wasn't there a case, I think, relatively recently, where an elector voted for somebody else that wasn't even on the ballot?
Yes. And that has happened. I mean, and that's what happened in 1960, too. The electors mostly voted for Harry Byrd, a senator from Virginia. And there have been other stray instances recently where an elector votes for somebody who's not on the ballot.
Boy, you know, the more you talk about it, the more bizarre it is. And I guess, what were the origins? Were they the origins of it similar to what the origins of having two Senate seats for the small states, the idea of the bias for rural America as opposed to the big, not that there were big cities in the days of the Founding Fathers, but what's the logic of having these electoral colleges in terms of the Constitution itself?
You know, the logic, it's a very interesting question, and I'll try to give you as brief an answer as I can. The starting point is that at the Constitutional Convention, they found this to be an extremely difficult thing to figure out. They could not agree. As the summer went on, they kept disagreeing, being able to come up with a plan. The most obvious way to choose a president would be to have let Congress choose a president. But there was also tremendous objections to that, because that would make the president beholden to Congress, and it would not have a real separation of powers. A second option was to have a popular election, and some people did favor that, but others had all sorts of objections to that. And in the end, a development which we can look back on somewhat wistfully or ruefully, at near the end of the many months of deliberation, with the procedure for the presidency still left untouched, or not, left undecided, not untouched, but undecided. Most of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention went off on a little vacation, and they left everything in the hands of a committee called the Committee on Unfinished Parts. And that committee came up with this idea of the electoral colleges. And basically the logic of it was to create a version of Congress. And in terms of representation, that's what it is, because it has you get electors for the two senators and all your representatives. So the apportionment of political power among the states is what was already agreed to with respect to Congress. They were creating a version of Congress that would meet once and have only one function, and thus would not make the president dependent on them and not make them corruptible.
So it's almost like a jury pool, right?
In a way, yeah.
Yeah, except
a structured jury pool.
Right, they are clearly chosen under some mechanism, and that's what's so puzzling here. But let's just return then in the last couple of minutes here, Alexander Kayser, to why we're having this conversation about the Electoral College, which is that in Thursday's New York Times, Joshua Horowitz has an article, "Would Donald Trump Quit If He Wins the Election? He Doesn't Rule It Out." And in the conversation, that Joshua Horowitz of the New York Times had with Donald Trump. He put that to him, whether he would win and then walk off as the winner, and Trump did not shoot that down. Now, there's been endless speculation, and I've been speculating myself for several months now that he's wanted more interest in winning the presidency than serving as a president. And there's also speculation that Donald Trump would seek a kind of exit strategy before the election to avoid humiliating loss if he continues on the current trajectory. And he's certainly not doing himself any favors when he's got Hillary Clinton on the ropes over the email server. What does he do? He has a completely rambling, incoherent rally at which he praises Saddam Hussein, of all people. So what's your I know that we've talked about this as a pure speculation, but do you have any sense? And by the way, I also mentioned that even at the convention itself, there's a growing movement amongst delegates who are apparently bound, but they're trying to find a way to unbound themselves, and there's lawsuits to do so. So there seems to be all kinds of off-ramps here being created for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I speak with no personal knowledge of him, but I certainly agree with the judgment or the perception that he seems more interested in the pageant of the election and in winning than in governing. I mean, one of the more notable things is that he doesn't seem to have much appetite at all for absorbing the kind of information, looking at the briefing books that's required to master a lot of critical issues that you might encounter. And even to understand, from what I can tell from some recent articles, even to understand the separation of powers within the government in the United States, there's a certain amount of knowledge that he seems uninterested in acquiring, which would suggest he would not be particularly interested in the work involved in being president.
Well, it does seem like a game. I mean, the way that he's playing around with the vice presidential thing seems like a game, with these various Republicans appearing on stage and then immediately saying that they're not running. My sense is that he's probably going to choose General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which would indicate at least that, you know, he's more likely to stay in the race, because it wouldn't just be him being humiliated, to be his running mate as well. Anyway, I guess we should end it there. Let's hope all of your research on this arcane electoral college doesn't come into play. At least I imagine.
That would certainly be my hope too. I should just add one thing at the end, just on this scenario with Jason Horowitz, which is there's a point at which, after the electors vote in the states, when their votes are sent to Congress and officially counted at a joint session of Congress. And once that happened, I think that if Trump stepped down, then his vice presidential candidate would likely become president. But until that point, with the murkiest scenario is if he stepped down somewhere between the casting of electoral votes and the counting of electoral votes. And that could be a period of about 5 or 6 weeks.
Well, all I can say is stay tuned, right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Alexander.
Sure, it's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Kesa, who is a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how Republicans are playing abortion politics at the expense of dealing with the Zika crisis. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and the director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. And he has an article at the Chicago Tribune, Congress Lets Abortion Politics Derail Zika Fight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Kaplan.
Thank you for having me.
And it is pretty extraordinary to think that at the moment, and as you point out in your article, the Zika virus doesn't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, but nevertheless, Republicans are making a stand, particularly against birth control, which seems to be about the only way that you can practically avoid contracting the Zika virus. And if you're pregnant, ending up with a baby with microcephaly. I mean, on Wednesday, House Republicans put forth funding proposals that would eliminate federal grants to help low-income women and men pay for birth control and other family planning services. They also proposed a cutting $108 million from the teen pregnancy prevention grants, all this to punish Planned Parenthood. And of course, this is the fifth time in 7 years that they've tried to scrap the Title X family planning program. So is there a rational explanation for this, or is this just, as you say, abortion politics?
I think it's just abortion politics. There's no rational reason whatsoever. If you were ever going to emphasize condom use, safe sex, this is the time, because obviously you can get Zika from a mosquito bite, but it has sexual transmission, and you want to interrupt that. Even the staunchest conservative, I think, would have to understand that abstinence is great, but relying on that alone doesn't work. We know that, so you've got to encourage safe sex as well. I know people disagree about abortion, but when you have a malformed infant that's not going to live, I'm not going to obligate any woman to carry that fetus to term. So this is the wrong place to take a stand. I don't think the American people support it in any way. I think it's simply irresponsible in the face of what will soon be more of an epidemic in the warmer parts of the United States.
Well, ironically, Arthur Kaplan, it's some of the warmer parts of the United States where 24 states have attempted to defund Planned Parenthood and similar providers. And there, this is, as I say, high temperature states which are mosquito friendly. So this business of going after this sort of jihad against Planned Parenthood is not just at the federal level. You've got 24 states doing the same stuff, and they're chipping away at safe and legal abortion, and they've declined to expand Medicare coverage. So this is not just happening on a federal level.
It isn't. It's happening at the state level. Absolutely true. And by the way, when you don't spend anything, which is what we've got allocated now, there's no money for mosquito control. There's no money for trying to get more bug spray out to people. I mean, this is across the board. It isn't just something that says, well, we're not paying for condoms or safe sex education. So in a way, when you have the red states primarily holding up funding, they're going to pay the biggest price, and the mosquitoes won't care whether they're rich or poor or conservatives or pro-choice or pro-life. They're just not going to care. So this is just the wrong place to have this fight. We've had it in the Supreme Court. That's fine. If you want to have it at the ballot box up, down on abortion, that's fine. But don't do it with respect to an epidemic that can really damage children, that can really create havoc and fear among the public in terms of their confidence in government. You know, it's been 9 months since the president made his request. Amount of funds allocated so far, zero. Number of cases of Zika in the U.S. and its territories, probably about 2,500 now.
But haven't there also been three babies born in the U.S. with microcephaly from the Zika virus?
And we have a big, big problem in Puerto Rico, one of those warmer places, it's likely to be a kind of forerunner of what could happen in Florida or Alabama or Mississippi. So I think the signs are there that things are underway. And so far, to have Congress go home without allocating anything to Zika prevention, boy, it'd be hard for me to defend that on any grounds, even if one was a very conservative person about contraception and abortion.
And again, I'm speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. And he has an article at the Chicago Tribune, Congress Lets Abortion Politics Derail Zika Fight. So let's just focus in then on where this funding or the lack thereof to deal with this Zika epidemic, which has struck South America and Central America, and as you mentioned, Puerto Rico, and is now spreading to the southern states of the United States, many of which ironically have gone out of their way to cut funds for contraception. Mm-hmm. And I mean, is there anything more you need to say about the importance of contraception in this regard? Because it seems to me, obviously, the best front line that we have since this Zika has spread through sexual intercourse, I think, more rapidly and readily than HIV, isn't it?
Well, at least as bad. And remember, we also don't know how long, once you're infected, the virus stays in your body. When I first started talking about this with respect to the Olympics and the World Health Organization, they were saying, well, 4 weeks, if you think you may have been bitten by a mosquito, that's enough. Then they shifted it to 8 weeks, but we really don't know how long the virus lingers, particularly in sperm. So you need to have those condoms not just when the mosquitoes are around, but for some time afterwards. And, you know, it would be great if people said, well, I'll just be abstinent during that time. I don't want to take any risks. But we know there's tons and tons of evidence that that doesn't happen. People find it very difficult to stay abstinent for months and months at a time. Some people want to try and have children. So they need education. They need to understand what practices could get them in trouble. Is it just sexual intercourse? Is it oral sex? Is it kissing? What's involved there? We don't know the answers to all of that. And then I think, again, you look out there and you say, well, if I've been somewhere where there's Zika, if I go to a country, I don't always have symptoms if I'm infected. So I can't always tell whether I might be at risk of giving it to someone else. Last big problem, if you don't contain this virus, it could get in the blood supply. Then we're all exposed.
So at this point, Senate Democrats have blocked a proposed $1.1 billion funding package. And that was, of course, laden down with Republican poison pills aimed at limiting funds for Planned mm-hmm. Parenthood and other women's health clinics. And we mentioned the latest round of Republican House restrictions on family planning and efforts to provide contraception to prevent the Zika from spreading. This is an old political game they play, right? They put it on must-pass legislation, but they laden it with poison pills, and they force the Democrats to veto or kill a bill, which then they can go out and tell their constituents that the Democrats stopped the funding, that it's not their fault.
Correct.
It's the other side. That's the game that's being played here, right?
That is the old political game, and it comes up with many issues. But I will say this. Congress is due to go out, I think, roughly a week, maybe 10 days. And if they go out, forget about all this fighting about emails and Star of David advertising and all the rest of it. If they can't get themselves together to do a straight up-down vote on appropriating money for Zika, it'll be too late by the time they come back. And they will have failed completely in their obligation. So I say, vote it up, down, no poison pills, no amendments, no nothing, just money for Zika, period. And if you won't do that, I'm not sure why you'd send them back to Congress.
Well, already, though, as you point out in your article at the Chicago Tribune, Arthur Kaplan, Congress let abortion politics derail the Zika fight. And you mentioned Florida being in the front line. It's going to be affected along with Alabama and other southern states. Senator Marco Rubio, who's certainly a conservative on all issues, and particularly abortion, he's warning that the GOP should take it seriously. So what's your sense of whether there's going to be some pragmatic and realistic politicians, even those that are anti-abortion, coming forth? Is Rubio, I think, the first of some? Or what's your sense of hope here? Because if you're a pregnant woman in living in the South, you've got to be, this has got to be the worst possible thing to put people through, not knowing whether they're going to give birth to a child with microcephaly who will either, you know, be deformed for life if they live that long. I mean, it's a horrible
very devastating neurological condition. We're not talking about Down syndrome or spina bifida. This strain of Zika really wreaks havoc with the brain. We don't even fully understand it. And by the way, it impacts other organ systems too. Lifespan is absolutely shortened. Some of these kids die within months after birth. So you don't want it to happen. I'm not usually in the habit of trying to depress listeners, but I think the odds are against, at this point, them doing something. The clock is ticking. Everybody seems to understand what the stakes are in terms of getting out there and doing something about this, and it hasn't moved them. So I fear that ideology may trump public health common sense.
Even if that ideology is met by reality in the very states that are often called the Bible Belt in the South, where the Zika virus is spreading.
I think if that virus does turn into a serious epidemic and affect hundreds of women, I think the Republican Party will pay for this in November. They are playing with fire here, because if you have an outbreak that could have been prevented and you take the stand that, well, it was promoting condom use or promoting sex education or even promoting abortion, again, with a condition like Zika impacting fetuses the way that it does, I don't think you're going to pull support. This is one of these areas where the majority of people are going to say, boy, I understand perhaps why a woman might decide not to carry that pregnancy to term. If you produce hundreds of those kids, it's going to have major political fallout, I think, right to the November election.
And do you think that the upcoming Olympics in Rio, where the Zika virus has really spread, and obviously there's going to be a lot of publicity and mentioning of Zika in the context of these games, not to mention other problems that are happening in Rio. So is that likely to have an accumulative effect in waking up the American people? I mean, I'm not sure how much attention they pay to the day-to-day activities of Congress. And obviously, we mentioned earlier that these are games that they're playing, where the Republicans are trying to blame the Democrats because they're the ones who vote against funding bills which are laden down with poison pills. So that's the game. But first of all, do you think anything's going to happen there in terms of athletes and others being afraid of catching the, you know, being...
Yeah. Well, look, it's winter in Rio, and that makes it a little less likely the mosquitoes will be around. If they get a warm snap, however, they're betting on the weather, and the mosquitoes will be up and moving and biting. What I really worry about is two things. One, the damage done. If you got infected through sex or mosquitoes in Rio, you won't see it for a while, so it disassociates a little bit, because the biggest impact is obviously the pregnancies and the babies, the fetuses, and so that's not going to be observed for weeks or months after the games. And then the other thing I worry about is people may bring the virus back to their home country where it didn't exist. We may have it here. Brazil obviously has it, Puerto Rico, Colombia, many other places. But when you bring all these people together and then they go home to Eritrea or Cameroon or other nations where there hasn't been any Zika, and they introduce it there, they could spread it rapidly to their own mosquitoes. And that's the theory of how it got to Brazil in the first place. So Sadly, there could be damage coming, but we may not see it until weeks or months after the games.
So in your article, Arthur Kaplan, at the Chicago Tribune, Congress Lets Abortion Politics Derail Zika Fight, you mention some of the polls that have come out, in the Kaiser Family Foundation poll. The statistics are pretty extraordinary, and this came out in June of the 30th. 81% of Democrats, 73% of Republicans, and 68% of independents surveyed support investing more federal funds to combat Zika. Now, that doesn't come as a surprise to me that this is something that most people recognize as a clear and present danger that should be dealt with. So, again, there seems to be a disconnect between the polls, the will of the people, and this kind of ideological obstruction going on in the Congress.
Right. I think it shows that the Congress is out of step with the American people on this one. Again, I understand issues around abortion and wanting to battle those out. I understand a little bit less sex education and condom use, because I think in those areas we've seen that they work and that just preaching abstinence does not. The American people are slowly getting on board those facts. And I think the Republican Party is just out of step on this one. I think that's not what the American people want them to do, try to fight the abortion wars over the Zika virus and the mosquitoes. That isn't the place to have the battle. If you're going to have the battle, have it elsewhere, but don't have it around this miserable disease.
So just in closing, you think the only thing that's going to wake up the Republicans in Congress is when women start contracting this through pregnancy, have babies with microcephaly. It's going to take that drastic and that tragic a step in order to get these people to recognize that they may be acting according to their particular ideology, but they're imposing, in effect, it on others who are the ones that suffer, not them.
Sadly, unless we really make a push in the next few days telling Congress to make the appropriation, I think that's exactly right. We will see tragedy. We will see political fallout, but it will all come too late because it could have been prevented.
Well, Arthur Kaplan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I mean, speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Nangong Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. And he has an article at the Chicago Tribune, Congress Lets Abortion Politics Derail Zika Fight. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.